This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate that took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of December 4th, 2007. This series of debates is sponsored by the Rosenkranz Foundation, and the proposition this time is, aid to Africa is doing more harm than good. The moderator for the night was WNYC New York radio host Brian Lehrer. The audience was polled before and after the event. We'll have the final results later in the program, but here's Brian with the entry poll results.
Before the debate, 24% of you voted for the motion, aid to Africa has done more harm than good. 34% of you voted against the motion, and the winner in the pre-debate vote was undecided with 42%. This is an open-minded audience.
There are three panelists on each side, and each gives an opening statement. We'll sample some of these statements, starting with William Easterly. He's the author of White Man's Burden, How the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill. He's arguing for the motion.
Good evening. I want to talk to you about two tragedies that are covered by this debate. The first tragedy we've already heard about, that there's a lot of unnecessary human suffering in Africa. That, for example, children's lives could be saved for a 12-cent dose of anti-malaria medication, could save them from dying from malaria. And that is indeed a tragedy, that children are dying for lack of a 12-cent medicine. Everyone here on the panel agrees that's a tragedy and feels compassion at this enormous tragedy. But there's also a second tragedy, and this is a tragedy that we hear a lot less about. This is the tragedy that we've already spent as official donors $600 billion in aid to Africa over the past 45 years. And after all that, children are still not getting the 12-cent medicines. So there were still between 1 and 3 million deaths from malaria last year. So aid would be a great thing if it worked. But the sad tragedy is that, and this is really one of the scandals of our generation, is that money meant for the most desperate people in the world is simply not reaching them. $600 billion in aid to Africa over the past 45 years. And over that time period, there's basically been zero rise in living standards, zero rise in incomes in Africa. The balance of the evidence suggests that the money is not reaching the poor. Sure, there is the occasional success, which we will hear about from time to time tonight, but the balance of the evidence is simply that $600 billion went into Africa and income did not rise. So where did the money go? Well, unfortunately, a lot of it went to corrupt and autocratic rulers. Despite all the talk of action against corruption, two-thirds of all aid today goes to rulers who have the worst rating on corruption. This is actually getting worse over time. And in fact, aid has gone into states that subsequently collapsed into warlord anarchy. There was a lot of aid that went into Sierra Leone, Liberia, Somalia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rwanda. In fact, even after the genocide broke out, the French were still supplying the Rwandan government, committing the genocide, with aid dollars, some of it military aid, obscenely enough. And so I say to you that aid, and this is borne out by statistical evidence, that aid worsens corruption, aid blocks democracy, aid is an obstacle to the freeing of Africans from predatory rulers. And I think we have no choice but to vote for the motion tonight. We cannot be satisfied with this record of aid that has promised so much and accomplished so little. We must condemn the sorry record of aid for the sake of Africa and for ourselves. It's simply unacceptable that a system which is supposed to have the best intentions is simply making things worse rather than better.
That was William Easterly. And now we'll hear an excerpt from the other side. Here's John MacArthur. He is Associate Director of the Center for Globalization and Sustainable Development at the Earth Institute at Columbia University.
When we actually look at the statistical evidence, we see that even when we compare governments with equal levels of good governance, we see that Africa, on average, grows about 2% per year slower than other developing countries around the world. Why is that? Why is it that countries like Ghana and Senegal have better Transparency International ratings than China and India, while it still grows so slowly while China and India take off? Why is it that Vietnam grows so quickly while it has governance ratings so far below Tanzania or Burkina Faso? It's because of the issues of disease, it's the lack of infrastructure, it's the lack of education, it's a terrible legacy of colonialism, but it's about much, much more than bad governments. There's no question that a bad government can drive a country off a cliff, but aid is about tackling those very practical challenges of health, education, and infrastructure if it's to be done properly. Now, Professor Easterly discussed the $600 billion of aid to Africa. That's the second myth, is that this is vast sums down the drain. How much is $600 billion if we think about it per African per year? If you divide that over all the years, over all the Africans, by my estimate, it's maybe $28 per African per year. That's all the money going down the drain. And then there's the third issue. Well, what do we get for it? We've heard that nothing has been achieved. Well, let's talk about some of those successes. There's the smallpox eradication that happened around the world, of course, thanks to, I have to say, the UN's World Health Organization that set the target, set up a smallpox eradication unit, and got rid of the disease. There's the fight against AIDS. In 2002, we had perhaps 50,000 people on antiretroviral treatment in Africa. Thanks to the creation of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, and the U.S. President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, we now have well over 1 million people on antiretroviral treatment within just 5 years. And for those of us who were in the trenches 5-7 years ago, this was considered impossible. Impossible. Just last week, we had the news that UNICEF, the Red Cross, and others had cut measles death in Africa by 91% between 2000 and 2006, from nearly 400,000 people a year, children, to 40,000 a year. They actually set a target to do that by 2010, and they were 4 years ahead of schedule. That was aid backing it. That was UNICEF, that was WHO, that was the American Red Cross, that was the Centers for Disease Control working with governments and the government national plans, and they got the job done. So let me just conclude by saying, first, just screaming governance and corruption is simply not the case. It's too simplistic, and it obscures the underlying truth of disease, lack of infrastructure, lack of education in Africa. Second, the scary big numbers that we often hear are actually quite tiny, in fact, minuscule, when we think of them in terms of the real people in Africa and what they're trying to achieve. Third, we see amazing successes each and every day, such as the eradication of measles, when practical strategies are set to achieve practical targets, no politics, just getting the job done. So it's with these three points in mind that I urge the House to reject the simplistic and misleading proposition that aid to Africa does more harm than good. And more importantly, let's join together to focus on the practical task of ensuring that aid builds on the successes to keep doing as much good as it possibly can. Thank you.
So, William Easterly, John MacArthur just listed some very specific examples of what he said are very significant successes: smallpox eradication, 1 million people on antiretrovirals who have HIV, once thought impossible. The UN and others cut measles deaths by 91%. Are these not significant successes when you said success stories are rare?
Well, one sign of the rarity of success stories is that I keep hearing the same ones over and over again. The smallpox example is given so often, and it happened so long ago that I think it should be consigned to history at this point. I'm not going to say that everything fails, that there are no successes. Smallpox was a success. But the fact that we keep citing the same thing over and over again suggests just how few successes there have been. The measles success, unfortunately, was until this new announcement, was actually on the ledger side of failure. A cheap and inexpensive measles vaccination had been available for decades and yet had not been used to save millions of lives from measles. So I'm not sure I would count that as much of a success at this point.
But is the answer to that, given what has taken place, just to stop aid?
You know, I'm not sure that we're voting tonight on whether to stop aid. I think we're voting on whether the existing aid system has done more harm than good. The existing aid system, I think we're arguing, is ineffective. It has bad political effects in propping up corrupt autocrats. And I think that system does more harm than good. I could imagine other aid systems that would do some good, that could save lives, if aid agencies were held accountable for results, which they are not now, if they were held accountable for failure, which they are not now. But we don't have that system at the present. We're voting on the system we have now, and that's the system that has failed us, unfortunately.
So, Gail Smith.
Here's a response from Gail Smith. She's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and she's speaking against the motion.
Well, I think aid systems can be improved, no question. I think that one of the problems, though, with this argument is that it suggests that none of that is happening. I think there are other successes out there. John did mention HIV and AIDS, which I think is significant, and the fact that success in measles is later than it should have been, I don't think, therefore, writes it off as a success. But I think we've also got a problem with terms here, and I think this is a bit too important to be slipshod with. For example, when you talk about $600 billion in aid, that conflates development aid and a lot of aid that was given for reasons having nothing to do with development. Let's not pretend for a minute that the aid the United States gave to Zaire during the Cold War was given for development, and you are judging it on the basis of whether or not it achieved development purposes. Second, I think you're suggesting that the fact that poverty still exists in epidemic proportions in Africa is because of aid. What about the terms of trade? What about commodity prices? What about war? What about drought? What about governments that may be ineffective? What about colonialism and the Cold War? I think the notion that the fact that poverty still exists in Africa because of aid is way oversimplified.
These are excerpts from a live Intelligence Squared debate on the motion, aid to Africa is doing more harm than good. Here's the moderator, Brian Lehrer, asking a question of David Reif. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and he is speaking for the motion.
David Reif, do you think the whole notion of aid to Africa as a means of improving standards of living is an impossible notion?
Well, what I think is impossible is the notion of aid as the centerpiece of development in Africa. My view, for what it's worth, is simply that the whole system of international development is structured around various modalities of aid. That's why I brought up the trade issue, which I insist is a real issue, because the terms of trade are stacked against Africa. To use only one example, they're not only stacked against Africa, they're stacked against other parts of the world as well. But to put it, you know, very bluntly, the system of trade at the moment is, in an age of rising commodity prices, nonetheless structured so that the actual producers of commodities get screwed by the system, the international system of trade. So my view is simply that by making development aid from the outside, whether it's national governments or intergovernmental institutions, the centerpiece of what you're doing means it's always going to fail.
John MacArthur, do the successes that you listed equate really to significant successes or exceptions, as William Easterly contends, if some of his other stats are true and two-thirds of aid is gobbled up by corrupt dictators and $600 billion spent, and more or less the standard of living on the continent has not gone up?
I'd like to make a few quick points. First, on the trade, just because that's come up, I think it's important to understand that if the so-called Doha trade agreement comes through, the estimates are that Africa might benefit about $1 billion per year. That's mainly an issue of cotton exporters. It's actually not an issue for most of the other commodities, and that's $1 billion, which is quite small when spread across 700 million people.
Wait a minute. David Reif, is that aid or is that something else, trade?
No, the disagreement is, if you're saying that my emphasis on trade, John, is not the Doha round. I mean, if we agree about the Doha round.
Right. I'm just saying that the trade is good, but it's not huge in quantitative terms. To Bill Easterly, I would say, I don't know what you expect to buy for $30 per person. You think, I say a million people, 1.3 million people on antiretrovirals in 5 years, and you say, huh, old story. I say 360,000 kids a year not dying. You say, huh, old story. I say 20 percentage point boost in primary enrollment in barely a decade. You say, huh, old story. I really don't know what you expect to buy for $30 per person. These are practical things. I'm not defending everything that's been done in aid policy. I'm not defending all of the machinery. Professor Easterly and I think, would agree on 9 out of 10 issues, and we have in many instances, on what needs to be done to actually improve the aid system.
Professor Easterly, the 1 million people on AIDS antiretrovirals, no big deal?
No, of course. It's prolonging their lives. That's great. I salute that. But
is that harm or is that good?
That's good. But let's be clear about these. Let's be clear about these numbers. For many African countries, aid is 20% of their GDP. If they had invested
$200 per capita,
if they had invested that, then the expectation of the aid advocates was that they would have had economic growth. And that simply is what did not happen. It did not get invested. We did not have growth.
Now part two.
We'll now continue with excerpts of the opening statements. Here's George Ayite. He's distinguished economist in residence at American University College of Arts and Sciences. He's arguing for the motion, aid to Africa is doing more harm than good.
Hello. Well, first of all, let me thank the Intelligence Squared for having this debate. And I personally, as an African, I find this very amusing that I could see proponents for and against aid. And I think those of us on this side really believe that you have to separate the humanitarian impulse from the record of aid itself. I mean, on the humanitarian impulse, we all want to help. As a matter of fact, a lot of people will say that it is the moral obligation of the rich to help the poor. But the record on aid has been a disaster. And that's why a lot of us, those of us who are on this particular side of the table, want to change. And what we're saying is that, look, the current system of aid harms Africa. There are a couple of misconceptions about aid that we need to clear up. First of all, foreign aid is not free. It is a very soft loan, which is given to a government at concessional rates. Now, the second thing about aid is that aid is tied. 80% of U.S. aid to Africa is spent right here in America on American contractors, American suppliers, and so forth. French aid is even worse. What Africans want, three things: reform, reform, reform. Reform the abominable political systems, reform the abominable economic systems and intellectual systems, give Africans the freedom so that they themselves can decide what is good for them. Africans know what they want. And if you want to better help the African people, ask them. Thank you.
The final opening statement came from C. Payne Lucas. He's senior advisor to All Africa Global Media, and here he is speaking against the motion.
Let me just say, for every corrupt politician in Africa, we have a history of some great politicians in Africa. There was a man who headed up a country by the name of Tanzania. His name was Nyerere. I can't recall the new president of Tanzania, but we're talking about his work in Tanzania and how this country is moving forward. In Mozambique, there was a man by the name of Juanjan Chissano. This year, he was voted a $5 million peace prize for the way he ran his country with good governance. I remember when people were giving him hell, but he said, wait, I'll prove to you that we can run this country and bring help to the people of this country. So he got a $5 million prize for doing things right. We also know about our president in Mali for now, who's doing a great job in Mali. These things just don't happen. Our ambassadors and our aid technicians, they work night and day in trying to make all these things happen. This is a complicated world we live in. Africa got 53 countries, 800 million people, and let me tell you something else. 9/11 will be coming back unless we respond sooner than later. And if we don't respond to Africa and their needs, the Chinese will, because the Chinese are coming. And they don't ask questions about democracy and good governance and free press and justice. They just want the raw materials.
George Ayite, you said that Africans want three things: reform, reform, and reform, economic reform, political reform, and intellectual reform. Do the United States or the United Nations have a role to play in that, in your opinion?
Well, the United States, the World Bank, United Nations can be helpful in reforming, trying to help Africa reform. But in the past, they've been more of a hindrance. And that is one of the, look, if you want to reform Africa, there are six basic institutions that you need. Number one, you need an independent and free media. That's the first critical institution. Americans take their media for granted. The second institution that you need is an independent judiciary for the rule of law. The third institution that you need is an independent electoral commission. You need to have an independent central bank. And then you want to have a neutral and professional armed forces and an efficient civil service. Give Africans these six institutions and it will do most of the cleaning out of Africa.
All right. Hang on.
You're listening to a debate on the motion, Aid to Africa is doing more harm than good. Next in the debate, each panelist was allowed to ask a question of the opposing side. We'll hear some excerpts, starting with Gail Smith. She's asking a question of George Ayite.
One of those advocates, I have never, ever presumed that economic growth was going to come about in Africa because of aid alone. And I think the fault underlying your motion is that presumption. And I think what this side of the table would argue is that aid is one of those tools and that it is having an increasingly positive impact, but that there are multiple other tools that must be brought to the table. My question boils down to wanting to understand whether you're giving aid far more potency than it actually ever could have or indeed should have.
The fact of the matter is, look, I personally believe that Africa doesn't need aid. And I have stated this, that Africa's begging bowl leaks horribly. I mean, you pour in aid, it just leaks out. Number one, corruption. Take the amount of aid which goes into Africa every year. The total, from all sources, $25 billion. Compare that to the leakages, $148 billion in corruption lost. $80 billion in capital flight out of Africa every year. Okay? How much money do African governments spend on the military and to purchase weapons? Okay? $15 billion. How much does Africa spend a year to import food? $20 billion. Back in the 1960s, Africa not only fed itself, it exported food. Okay? If we are able to plug all these leakages, we'll find more than enough money than the double the aid that Tony Blair and Bono and Sachs want to give to Africa. Okay? That's my position. But aid has become an industry replete with its own lobbies. Okay? They want that to continue because aid, if you ask George Soros, he will tell you that aid benefits the donors more than the recipients. They would like to have this and continue, okay? What to do? All right, this is where I say that if you want to ask the Africans, ask them what type of help they need. And this is why I believe that the mechanism that we have today, it's not working. It has to be reformed so that it benefits those that it is intended to do.
The next question goes to William Easterly.
Okay, well, this question is partly based on my experience at the World Bank, where I spent part of my career and founded a not very effective bureaucracy to resolve the world's problems. I want to read a couple of quotes. The first goes, the international system is ill-equipped to provide aid because of a shortage of effective institutional arrangements and, above all, resolve to translate commitments into action. And the second quote is, our foreign aid system is broken. So it sounds like these quotes would be from this side of the table, but actually the first quote is from you, John, from the report Investing in Development. And the second quote is from you, Gil, from your testimony to Congress. So it seems like you kind of agree that our foreign aid system is broken and is not working.
So I'd like to actually just read a quote. It says, foreign aid likely contributed to some notable successes on a global scale, such as dramatic improvement in health and education indicators in poor countries. Life expectancy has risen from 48 years to 68 years. 40 years ago, 131 out of every 1,000 babies born in poor countries died before reaching their first birthday. Today, 36 out of every 1,000 babies die. Routine children immunization combined with measles vaccinations in seven southern African nations starting in 1996 virtually eliminated measles in those countries by 2000. Donors collaborated on a program to wipe out river blindness in West Africa starting in 1974, virtually halting the transmission of the disease. 18 million children in 20 country area of the program have been kept safe from river blindness since the program began. Pause. Let's put the focus back where it belongs. Get the poorest people in the world such obvious goods as the vaccines, the antibiotics, the food supplements, the improved seeds, the fertilizer, the roads, the boreholes, the water pipes, the textbooks, and the nurses. This is not making the poor dependent on handouts. It is giving the poorest people the health, nutrition, education, and other inputs that raise the payoff to their own efforts to better their own lives. That's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what these success stories are doing. And I congratulate Professor Easterly for writing that in his recent book, White Man's Burden.
And I did write the line and testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that our foreign aid system is broken. And it is absolutely broken. But that's not what we're here to debate. If the question before us is the U.S. government foreign aid system broken, you would have unanimous agreement. This would be a very short debate, and we would be now drinking. What we're debating is whether the aid that comes out of that system is doing more harm than good to Africa. I don't believe that it is. I think it could do a lot more good. I think it could do better. I think it could be more efficient, both in the eyes of American taxpayers and, importantly, as I think all of us agree, the Africans whose lives it is intended to change. But on the question of the aid system, absolutely it's broken.
But you are arguing that a broken system still does more good than harm.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes, because if you look at what has been achieved, and I refer not only to the kinds of things that John talked about, but if you look at things like microfinance, like a commodity exchange, like the provision of wireless services, those things matter in people's lives, and I believe that that is doing good. Could it do better? Absolutely.
C. Payne Lucas, you get the next question.
Well, I'd like to ask my friend George, my question is, what would you do with, we end all this aid so the corrupt politicians can't steal our money anymore. What would you put in this place? And especially in those countries that don't have any natural resources, don't have any infrastructure, and who are barely living on $100 a year.
Well, first of all, corruption is not an issue that the U.S. should fight. It's Africans who have to fight that battle themselves, okay? If you want to fight corruption, there are three basic institutions that you need. A free and independent media to expose it. The second is to have an aggressive attorney general to prosecute the corrupt. The third institution that you need is an independent judiciary to enforce the rule of law. Are some of the institutions that we need to fight these battles ourselves. I have indicated that the aid resources Africa desperately needs can be found in Africa. I coined the expression African solutions for African problems. We're not going to go to America. We're not going to go to China. We're not going to go to France. We're not going to go to Britain and beg, because this devalues our pride and dignity. And this is why I said that the solutions to Africa's problems
lie in Africa itself.
George Ayite, you get to ask a question of the other side.
Now, let me put this directly to you, Mr. Siepen Lucas, since you've been involved in Africa. Whom exactly do you want to help in Africa? The African governments or the African people? Now, there's a distinction between these two. Most Americans think that the best way of helping the African people is by handing money over to their corrupt and incompetent governments. Where do you stand on this?
Well, I think we ought to help the African people. That's why we have hundreds and hundreds of NGOs who are doing programs all over Africa, for which the government never touches one dime of the money. That's who we want to help. We want to help the people. And those governments who want some help about how to create a good governance and a free press and the rule of law, we stand ready to help them too. But you got to remember, a lot of aid to Africa never goes near the government bureaucracy. You got to remember that. That's an important piece of the work.
All right.
This is an Intelligence Squared U.S. debate on the proposition aid to Africa is doing more harm than good. We'll now rejoin the discussion period with questions from the audience.
So we have a questioner on this side.
Hello, it's Yuval Naidoo, president of the South African Chamber of Commerce in America. I have a question for both sides. As a fourth-generation South African and African, people often talk about a Marshall Plan. Discussing this with my African colleagues is often met as a suggestion of utter nonsense, or it's met as a suggestion that's needed. Is this part of the solution? The other point is that in many discussions on aid, and particularly with African colleagues, many of us feel excluded from the decisions of where aid goes. Is this a perception? If it is a perception, what can be done to alter this perception? If it is reality that Africans are not involved in these decisions of where these billions of dollars go, what can then be done? Thank you.
Would somebody on the con side like to answer first?
I just would want to make a couple of quick points.
John MacArthur.
The Marshall Plan is actually an interesting example for many reasons, because that actually worked out to, just for reference, $85 per European per year in constant dollar terms. That was to a rich country doing a bunch of stuff after a war. We give a fraction of that to Africa, which has much deeper needs and much deeper poverty today, when we give support totally of $30 per capita. But in terms of your last question of the exclusion from where the aid goes, it actually answers the Marshall Plan point too. I think the basic proposition has to be that the Africans are empowered to put forward their own plans. The countries put forward their proposals, they submit the proposal to the pool of funds, and then the funding actually is made available to finance that proposal. It's that notion of supporting the African countries to put in action their own plans.
Someone on the pro side?
Yeah. Let me do it, if
David,
I may.
David Reif?
I think the Marshall Plan is precisely interesting because it comes back to the point that George Ayite keeps making and I think is the essential point, which is the point of the state. The problem with the Marshall Plan, John, is not that it was $85 to a small number of states rather than $30. It was that there are functioning states there to administer it. The Marshall Plan would have had no hope whatsoever of working historically had the Allied powers in the aftermath of World War II not reestablished the German state, for one thing. It was the first thing that they did when they arrived. So you cannot get around this question, which is, we talk all this, I mean, civil society is a descriptive term that keeps being misused in the NGO world as a prescriptive term all the time. It's not as if civil society can stand up to the power of the state like that. So that, you know, these models seem to me to avoid the problem because precisely people don't want to talk about politics, precisely because I think, with all due respect, the mistake that both particularly U.S. NGOs and the U.N. system make over and over again is the idea that you can ring-fence aid from politics. You can't.
May I?
Gail Smith.
I have a problem with this motion because it's not very scientific. I mean, what is aid? There's U.S. government aid. There are billions of dollars in aid. There's the Gates Foundation. The prize that C. Payne mentioned that was given to President Chissano of Mozambique was given by an African foundation. That was African aid if you will, or African philanthropy. But I think there are a number of things that are being conflated, and these tools can be used effectively or ineffectively, but they're not all the same, and some have constraints on them and some don't. I think also on the Marshall Plan, there's something we're ignoring here. Again, we are suggesting somehow that aid is like the invention of the wheel, and that aid is going to be the thing that transforms Africa. And I think if we all thought about it, we would reject that. But the way we're discussing it suggests otherwise. The Marshall Plan, yes, had to do with reestablishing states. It also had a lot to do with policy. It wasn't just aid. There were policies regarding the terms of trade and other things that were afforded Europe that have not been afforded Africa. So let's not hold aid accountable for the fact that the terms of trade are skewed against Africa.
If you're going to make a distinction between government aid and private aid, like from the Gates Foundation, what is that distinction, very briefly? And can private aid do things that government aid cannot?
Yes, I think private aid is much, much more flexible. At one level, you're right, David. I mean, government aid is always going to have, to some extent, politics, but also taxpayer accountability over it, assuming that that's something we can achieve again in the near term.
Is there any comment?
But I have to make one point here. I think it is a gross disservice to Africa to suggest that all African governments are corrupt, that every leader is evil, that there are no African states. Africa is a very, very diverse place. And to that young woman who is 18 or 19 years old in Ghana or Zambia or even Zimbabwe, who hopes to go to work in a government ministry to serve her people, I think we need to be a little bit careful about suggesting that all governments in Africa are bad. Because, God forbid, if they don't have governments, it all looks like some
other. There were 18-year-old women in Stalin's Russia right. who had the same ambitions.
David,
I don't see the point of that, really.
Just 30 seconds on private aid. Is there any common ground there? Is Gates Foundation aid?
It used to be said in the 90s when George Soros had more money that he did what the United States didn't have the money to do. I think this is quite an interlocking net of institutions. Aid is a system. It's an international system. And the idea that somehow you can say, well, governments, that's not good, but somehow Gates or Soros. The truth is, this is one system. And again, it's a system that doesn't work.
Okay. One more question from the floor. Who's got it? All the way in the back.
Yes. Bill Hartung from the New America Foundation. Do you think that aid, military or economic, can be part of a platform, can contribute to an effort to reduce conflict in Africa?
Yeah, could I just say, I think it's important to keep in mind how poor much of Africa is. So it's actually not the right comparison to compare to Europe, which was, you know, poorest country was maybe $5,000 per capita 50 years ago, 60 years ago. We're talking about countries at $200 per capita, where a bed net or $8 for a school fee makes a big difference. So if you want to actually prevent conflict in places where the rains fail and people fight and conflict is exacerbated when the rains fail because there's not enough food, I would support fertilizer and seeds to grow more food. This is a really practical point. I think we need to understand also that there are so many countries with great governments, and if there are 16 or 18 or 25 or however many where we can all agree the governments are fantastic, if it's just about governance, why aren't those countries just taking off all across Africa? Why aren't we seeing 10% growth all across Africa? Because there's more to it. And even the most heroic leaders in Africa, in Mali, in Burkina Faso, in Tanzania, in Malawi, they're all facing deep challenges of extreme poverty where people have no money, they can't afford a bed net, they can't afford a $25 bag of fertilizer, a $10 can of seeds, and they're too poor to get on that first rung of the ladder of economic development. And aid can help do that. It's not enough to do that, but we have to understand what it is trying to achieve. And I think 1.3 million people on antiretrovirals is a pretty good start. Thank you.
And now the final remarks from the panelists, beginning with the side opposing the motion, Gail Smith.
I think it's important to note that this debate is in the present tense. It's not in the past tense. The question is aid to Africa doing more harm than good? No, I don't think it is. I think it's more doing more good than harm. Can it do more good? Absolutely. But I think if we hold aid accountable for all of Africa's ills, we're going to lose sight of what aid can do. Aid is changing people's lives. It is investing in transformation. It is imperfect, but it has improved exponentially. And I think if you asked a majority of people, whether they be people whose children are alive today because they've got ARVs, or whether they be people who now have access to wireless internet, and whether that aid came from a private foundation, from a government, from an individual through an NGO, I think they would say it's doing a lot of good, and I hope you will vote accordingly.
David Reif.
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is distinguish between aid and help. The reason that this side of the table has kept arguing and insisting that aid does more harm than good is not because we're against help, but because aid is a system, and that system is corrupt, inefficient, and wrong-headed in the main. That you can have a zillion anecdotes that anyone would rather have, as I put it about humanitarianism, a bed for the night than no bed for the night, doesn't make it a good system. Yes, if the only relief you get is someone bringing you a bed net or some fertilizer, and the choice is formulated as, would you prefer a bed net or would you prefer nothing? Well, then sure, then that you get a nice kind of Enver Hoxha-style majority for aid. But those aren't the choices. The choices are talking about things that would have, if implemented, fair trade being, in my view, the most important, would have infinitely more positive effects. And that in effect, by concentrating on aid, we are ignoring, in fact, the things that actually would make people's lives better. That they would say, I'll still take aid if my choices are aid and nothing. Yeah, but that's really not the issue here.
John MacArthur.
Thank you, and thank you to the audience and to the panel. And I just want to stress that I'm of the view that we're all aiming for the same ambition, which is to support people who want to make their own lives better throughout Africa. And so I want to also make sure we don't lose track of the key question, which is whether aid does more harm than good. We've talked about all these elements of the question, each of which suggests it's just not a good way to frame the point. The point is that $30 per person doesn't buy you much. And the fact that we have so many successes shows actually that aid can do tremendous good. Does it solve all the problems in the world? No. Is it enough to provide magic across a continent? No. Should we put it into the arms of corrupt leaders? No. Do we do that on purpose anywhere? No. Do we stop doing it across the continent when it's caught? That's the point. We need to focus on the things that people are asking for and they want, the bed nets, the fertilizer, the medicine, the schools. We're seeing tens of millions of people benefit from those programs, and I urge you to reject this motion because it's not even the right way to think about supporting those who want it. Thank you.
William Easterly.
Well, I wasn't the one who invented the objective of the end of poverty being the objective of aid. That's the title of Jeff Sachs's book, The Boss of John MacArthur. That's the goal of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, to end poverty. And what I'm arguing, and all of us on this side are arguing, is that's an unrealistic and unattainable goal, that aid cannot achieve the end of poverty. And in fact, an aid system that is designed as it is now to be mainly about ending poverty cannot even be held accountable for anyone doing even these modest, tangible things that all of us agree are good things to do. Because money does not, unfortunately, automatically translate into results. The fact that you can say, for example, that a 10-cent oral rehydration therapy kit will save a baby's life from dying from dehydration due to diarrhea. Of course, there's enough money there to pay for these 10-cent kits. And yet still, 2 million babies died last year from dehydration for lack of these 10-cent kits. And what I cannot support is an aid system that aims at these utopian, unattainable objectives of achieving the end of poverty, which is up to the Africans themselves, not to patronizing Western donors. And I would support a system that does focus on modest, tangible goals that aid agencies will be held accountable for, that they will be blamed when someone is supposed to get oral rehydration kits and doesn't get them and a baby dies. That is an aid system that would work, but that is not the aid system that we have now. The aid system that we have now does more harm than good by propping up the corrupt autocrats under the illusion of creating development, which aid has failed to make any progress on throughout its history.
C. Payne Lucas.
They're ignoring the motion. It is not about the aid system. It's not about ending poverty. It is about whether aid does good or harm. One of the things that we have this evening, we have to remember that aid is always changing. For the last 22 months, we have been meeting under a congressional mandate on how to make aid more effective. We created a Millennium Challenge account, in which in one country like Ghana, we made $500 million available to the private sector that the government had nothing to do with. In order to get that money, they had to have rule of law, they had to have freedom of speech, they had to be accountable to the bookkeeping that we imposed, and it was run entirely by Ghanaians. The new paradigm for us in aid is it must be locally owned. It has to be sustainable, it has to be accountable, and it has to be evaluated all along the trail. So we are now in a partnership with the religious and faith-based organizations. We're in a partnership with our allies. We're in a partnership with NGOs. We're in partnerships with Doctors Without Borders, coming together to find the right solution to make it work. We do know one thing. It has to be African-led and African-owned.
George Ayite, your closing remarks.
Well, thank you very much. I think, you know, Americans are very generous people, and they certainly would like to help Africa. But quite often, very often, they have been sort of encumbered by political correctness, the unwillingness to criticize bad policies in Africa for fear that if you're a white person, you criticize a black African leader, you'd be labeled racist. That has silenced a lot of people. The nonsense in Africa must stop. Bad leadership is one of our many problems in Africa. And the foreign aid donors compound this problem. Let me give you an example. In 1979, the Norwegian aid agency went to Kenya to help the Turkana tribes people. And the Norwegian aid agency decided that the best way of helping the Turkana tribes people is to build them a fish freezing plant. After the plant was built at a cost of $25, all the media people were invited. Even the village brass band was invited. But there was a small problem. They discovered that the Turkana people don't fish. They raise goats. Now, we have seen blunders upon blunders of such foreign aid programs in Africa. Now, we are asking you to vote for the motion, not because you want to cut off aid, but to send a strong message that the system needs to be reformed so that better aid, smart aid, is sent to Africa. Thank you.
Here's the moderator, Brian Lehrer, once more with the final results from the audience poll.
And now, the debate results. Remember, before the debate, you voted 24% for the motion, 34% against the motion, and 42% undecided. After our debaters did their best to sway you, you voted 41% for the motion, 51% against the motion, 8% were undecided, which means those opposed to the motion have carried the day. Congratulations. And thanks again to all of you for coming. Good night.
And that concludes our debate. To hear the full unedited version of this or other debates in the IQ Squared series, or to subscribe to our podcast, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. Debate Series is an initiative of the Rosencrantz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosencrantz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series or to find out how you can get tickets to attend future live events, visit www.iq2us.org. That's www.iq2us.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared U.S. is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC in New York. Producer Rob Christensen, senior producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Damon Whittemore and Edward Haber. Intelligence Squared U.S. is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.